Let's pick the brain of another retirement planner, my friend Brian Tegmeyer from Truly Prosper Financial Planning. And this is the 85th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. We have another great edition today of another fellow retirement planning here, none other than Brian Tegmeyer.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Happy you can be here. So, and Brian has a firm, Truly Prosper Financial Planning, based out of Columbus, Ohio, which he'll get more into. And Brian and I know each other from a group we're in called the Mastermind Group, or a study group, same as Larry, who was on last month, Larry Pershing. We're all in the same group. And we meet virtually about once a month, and we discuss all sorts of things about our practices, about technical aspects of retirement planning and what have you. And it's great because we're all relatively small operations, you know, one-person shop, two-person shops. And it's a good network. We learn from each other. It's a source to go to ask questions. No one can know everything about everything, especially when you're a relatively small firm like ours. So it's great that we have these networks of folks we can help rely on and learn from and ask questions to. So Brian, thank you for being part of that network with me and sharing insight and experience. Much appreciated.
Oh, yeah.
Before we get going, Brian, I have a question for you. It's more of a statement, actually. But so I was making something in the oven yesterday. And the recipe said set the oven to 180 degrees. Well, now I can't open it because the door is facing the wall, right?
That's good.
Hold on. Yeah?
That's good.
All right. That's all. I got one more for you, just in case you didn't like that one. Not that I can promise this, the next one will be any better. I just got fired. As severance, my company gave me a bag of used coffee. Do you know why?
Why?
Because they said it was grounds for termination. Yeah, it's so painful.
That's good. Now, I do like both of those jokes, but I have to tell you, my favorite jokes are actually elevator jokes.
What's an elevator joke?
I feel like they work on many levels.
Oh, they do. Hold on. They definitely do. Good one.
Okay, there we go.
Being prepared. I liked it.
Now we have this started off right. We have the jokes in.
We do. That's the most important thing. We could just wrap this now and go home.
I think that's why people are here, is really for the jokes, and then the bonus is hearing about retirement planning.
Right. That boring stuff.
Yeah.
So, all right, with the fun stuff out of the way, let's get into it. So, Brian, can you give a quick background of yourself and your business?
Yeah, so I got into financial planning in 2011, actually got a degree in financial services, took the CFP exam, and actually had absolutely zero planning experience when I took the exam. So then I ended up getting a job at a firm in Cincinnati, and it was very interesting to start translating all of this book knowledge and thinking I'm so smart about planning and start translating it into reality. And one of the things, the firm was very planning focused. They were a fee-only firm. And one of the things they had me do from the very beginning was actually we used MoneyTree was the financial planning software we used. So it was cash flow based. I had to basically take all of the exhibits and reproduce them in Excel using formulas, you know, calculating RMDs, calculating the return, using mid-year convention. But he didn't tell me anything. So I had to figure it all out, and the numbers had to match exactly. And the whole point was, look, we need to know exactly where all the numbers come from in the model. So that kind of started this path of, one, very focused on retirement planning, but also very focused on the details, because the advisor that trained me was very detail oriented. So really got me focused on not just, okay, what numbers do we put in, but how did the numbers matter? Where do we put the numbers? And I was actually with them for about 10 years and then decided to start my own firm in 2021.
Okay. So you got solid, what are we now? We're 2024. So 13 years experience, now going on 3 years of your own firm.
Yep. Excellent.
And your firm, so Truly Prosper Financial Planning, based in Columbus, how do you operate? Are you local? Are you, you know, in person? Are you virtual? What's the fee structure and services like?
Yeah. So in 2021, there wasn't much of a choice. It was virtual by default. Just nobody wanted to meet at that point. So started out virtual. It was convenient, but I do like meeting clients in person when I can, at least once a year. So for local clients, you know, in Columbus or Dayton area, we'll meet in person, or even Cincinnati, we can meet in person. Out of state, generally, just we may meet in person occasionally, but mostly virtual. Yeah. And my clients are, you know, a lot are in Ohio, but then I do have some Indiana, Kentucky, and I do even work with Michigan people. We just don't talk about football. We kind of have that agreement. So But yeah, so my firm, I basically only work with people over 50. I actually only have one client under 50, and it's a family friend, and that's about the only one. So really focus heavily on retirees, and even more specifically, people making that transition to retirement and all the questions they're starting to ask, which we'll kind of get into some of that today, but just really love the strategy that goes into retirement. And it's interesting, when I started in financial planning, I was mid-20s, and I actually was, I was not as happy that the firm only worked with retirees. You know, I wanted to help younger people. I wanted to help them build wealth, and then just really got into retirement planning. And so decided to focus my business exclusively on that. You may even remember this, Andy, but when I first started, you know, I actually, one of the things I noticed, there were people who didn't necessarily want asset management or weren't quite at retirement with assets to manage and needed advice. So I actually started my business as an advice only firm. I think that's a good term for people to know is, you know, if you want somebody to help you and not necessarily manage your money, the phrase advice only would be a good thing to search. But I started out there where I just wanted to give people the advice and let them implement. And over time, what I found, you know, just personally, it's a lot of work to keep doing these plans, keep getting new clients. So that was one reason I kind of shifted to flat fee. But then I also started noticing, you know, people weren't necessarily understanding as well, implementing correctly. I would have people come back and maybe they didn't talk to the estate planning attorney like they were supposed to, or didn't make the recommendation, didn't do the recommendations. So I started shifting more to this flat fee model. And let me just see. So very similar to Andy, I do a flat fee, financial planning, investment management, and tax planning is kind of my primary offering. Occasionally do one-time plans for retirees, but mostly focused on the ongoing service at this point.
Got it. Thanks. Yeah. I also started, when I started my business, I was doing, I offered the full ongoing relationship, but also did the quote unquote advice only, which again, like you said, it's an important thing for people to know. That means they do not manage investments for you. It's just the planning, just the advice. Maybe it's ongoing, maybe it's hourly, maybe it's a one-time and done thing, but that's advice only. And I similarly did some pure hourly work. I also did some one-time plans. And yeah, it's a lot of work, but that wasn't the reason I stopped doing it. It was more so, in many cases, the people, like you said, wouldn't follow through. And it's not their fault. It's just a plan is basically worthless unless there's implementation and follow up and follow through afterward to make sure stuff gets done. And plans change. Life changes, markets change, yeah. Tax legislation changes. So whatever plan you did a year ago, 5 years ago, like rip it up and throw it out, because it's probably close to not worthless, but you know, it's not as good as it should be at this point. So I felt the real value is doing ongoing relationships. And sure enough, that's what I've found. It's more enjoyable for me. I think clients get more out of it, more value out of it. And it sounds like, you know, you've kind of had the same experiences. So,
yeah. And I think people, it's interesting when somebody says they want the advice, but they like to do it themselves. You know, it is interesting to have them elaborate, what parts of it do you like to do yourself? Because really what I find when people say, I like to do it myself, it really is mostly investments. It's right. Doing the trades themselves. It's watching the stock market. It's not everything else that we talk about when we talk about retirement planning. And they're missing those pieces and sometimes don't even know that they're factors. But it's really just, hey, investments are not that difficult. I'm using index funds. I like doing that myself. So I'm going to do everything myself, which is fair if you don't know. But I mean, we'll get into it a little more. There's a lot more involved in planning. I think they were starting to see that as we went.
Yeah. And just final comment on this. I don't want to belabor this too much, but there are a lot of people who do advice only, and I'm glad they do because there's a lot of demand for that. But the other sort of challenge and difficulty I found was average folk, average consumer, don't really understand how complicated and involved seemingly simple and direct questions are that can't be answered properly in a 1 hour, 2 hour engagement. Like common example is, when should I start Social Security? On the surface, someone may think that's an easy question. Sit down for 20 minutes, you know, tell me what I need to know and we're good. But most decisions in retirement planning can't be made in a vacuum. And you really truly have to consider all the other aspects of their plan, other sources of income, life circumstances, investments, longevity, whatever, pension if they have one. All this ties together in figuring out the question of when should I start Social Security. So it's not something that can be done in this short, sweet thing. And like almost a lot of questions really do involve a full blown plan and analysis, not necessarily ongoing, but at least a full, full once over. So that's why I struggled and stopped with it. You know, the pure advice hourly only, it was hard to make that work well.
Yep.
Anyway, So I was going to ask you, when did you, or why did you get into retirement planning? We already went into that. You sort of didn't start that way, but ended up that way.
Yep.
Okay, fair
enough. Yeah, I think just to add one comment I would add is, so I really liked the financial aspects of it, but then I also liked the non-financial aspects, you know, this transition to retirement, the purpose factor, living with intention, you know, some of those elements, which is part of why I do financial life planning for retirees and try to get at some of those non-financial factors. I really enjoyed those conversations as well. And that's part of one of the reasons I named my business Truly Prosper. You know, we can have all the money we want, but what are we going to do with it? What's the life we're going to live? So it's kind of some of the more fulfillment part. I also like that because I feel like retirees are at this pivotal point where they're willing to engage and think about that. And yeah, if they're not before retirement, then once they retire, they realize they need to. So it's nice to help guide them through that process as well.
And can you tell me a little more about that the life planning aspect of things? Like, we all know the technical financial aspects and the typical forms of designations and education involved. Yeah. What's the life planning aspect you mentioned?
So there's a few main groups. So George Kinder does some type of life planning training. And then there's a group called Money Quotient that has some good tools and resources. And that's the one that I use. So it's a combination of questionnaires and conversations to help people dig a little deeper into the purpose. So, I mean, we're asking questions about, you know, money history. We're learning a little more about money history. And then we're also, you know, you even using a wheel of life to say, okay, a lot of times we limit financial planning to just that financial part of the wheel. But right, how are you doing in the other areas? How do we think that will change once you retire? So it starts helping people think about other areas to focus on as well once they retire. And maybe they realize, hey, I've really neglected my health, and that's an area they want to improve. So then we can build that into the plan because there, you know, whether it's the cost of memberships or, you know, maybe things get more expensive, there are some financial implications to some of those as well.
Sure. That's really important. The non-financial aspect of retirement, I think a lot of people may not give enough focus and attention and planning to until it lands on them sort of the hard way.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that was one of the questions too. I mean, that is one of the key areas I feel like people are neglecting is the non-financial factors. Exactly. You know, how it's this idea of how do I maintain purpose in retirement? But then also this idea of, I feel like retirees, like sometimes, and we joke about it, they're always busy. You know, it's funny. Right. I worked with a couple recently, you know, one of them's still working, one of them's not. It's the working one that got the questionnaire done. The retiree was too busy, you know, it's because they're just doing things. And I think it's easy to kind of lose a sense of urgency when all of your time is your time and not necessarily step back and say, how do I want to spend the time in being intentional? So I think some of those factors can get lost when we're thinking about retirement, and it's just retiring and just starting to do whatever it is you're asked to do. In some cases it's, hey, you know, you become the full-time caregiver for your grandkids or babysitter. You know, it's like, if that's what you want to do, great. But if you don't want to, then it's good to start thinking about that, set some boundaries. Maybe it's once a week. So just very practical ways of saying, okay, that's time. Now health, like all these non-financial factors, starting to think about it, and then it will evolve. But I think that's neglected. And then I think the other area that's often neglected is actually tax planning. And it's kind of funny, like people come to me, one of their top concerns is tax planning, but they don't often even know what that means. It was funny. Somebody recently said, like they put on the questionnaire, tax planning is one of their top concerns. And then halfway through, they're like, so what exactly is tax planning? What's your role in it? What does it look like? So I think it's, you know, sometimes we think it's, should I do Roth conversions or not? That's what some people maybe hear about that. And they think that's tax planning, but there's a lot more involved in tax planning, as you know, that I think people actually overlook. And they're just focused on one small piece and don't appreciate the value of good planning all around.
Yeah. And it's good that tax planning, I don't want to say it's becoming a buzzword, but it's becoming more in fashion of a word, both
exactly
the advisory community and consumers starting to hear more about it. There's not a standard definition of what it is, what it includes, what it doesn't. Right. Even with myself, I sort of feel like I know it when I see it, but otherwise it's hard to define what tax planning is. But nonetheless, it's more becoming more front and center for folks. So it's good that people are asking, like the person you just mentioned, that said they want it, even though they don't really know what it is. So like,
yeah,
they heard about it somewhere, you know, which is a start. It's better than it used to be. So,
and I think for us, it helps that we can narrow into retirees. What is good tax planning for retirees? And we can start to define it a little better. But you're right. It's still a little tough because there's lots of elements to it. But if you know, you have the tax background. I did a lot of tax planning for retiree clients at the previous firm. So we kind of get it through training that way. And right, even when you even when you learn it in the CFP, it's very limited. So you have to actually start digging in and learning it through application.
Yeah, fair. So you said one of the things, or some of the things that people don't give enough attention to in your experience, is the softer side, sort of life, non-financial yeah. aspects in tax planning. On the flip side, what do you think are things that some folks you come across give too much focus or attention to in retirement planning?
So it's watching the stock market and investments. You know, it seems like everybody wants to focus on investments as the primary thing. You need to have a good strategy, but once you have a good plan in place, you do not need to watch it every day. And I think people are surprised. If you call me on any given day, I'm not going to know what the stock market's doing. I don't even pay attention because it's not really relevant to what I'm doing. Unless I'm doing trades for a client, I might make sure things aren't crazy that specific day. But other than that, I'm not as worried about what the stock market is doing any given day or even week. You know, longer term, we're looking at it, but it's not something we need to fixate on.
Sure. Agreed. I guarantee a good chunk of my clients can tell you much more quickly and accurately than I can what the stock market's doing
right.
any given day.
Yeah.
All right. So this question, you know, these questions we're asking, just to recap for people, these are the same list of questions I want to ask all of the fellow planners that come on. So everyone can kind of have the same framework, you know, listeners can have the same framework of questions answered by different folks to get different views and opinions and approaches on these things. So next question is, what do you think are some of the some of the common differences in planning, retirement planning, for single folks versus married couples, or not necessarily married, but, you know, partners, however that's defined?
Yeah, I think leading up to retirement, I think it can be tougher for single people to save enough for retirement. You know, they don't have the shared expenses with a partner, so it could be harder to even get enough saved. And another factor is considering care later on. You know, a couple may have their spouse to help care for them. So I see more concerns with single people on who's going to care for me if I need it. And they may even be more inclined to want to get insurance. Just, hey, I don't want to be a burden on kids or a friend. So they may be more inclined to want to either get insurance or make sure they have a good plan in place to self-insure. Another factor is, you know, with single people, we're dealing with one life expectancy. With a couple, we're dealing with two. So just with planning, I generally, for couples, might use a higher life expectancy for the couple, because the odds of one of them living longer and a single person, the horizon can be shorter, unless there's longevity in the family, we need to use a longer age. But generally, it's a little shorter for individuals, which makes planning a little easier. And yeah. then another factor too is just with couples, you know, they're having to coordinate and, you know, compromise on some of their plans, where a single individual doesn't. So, I mean, that does make some of the planning easier for them. But then on the flip side, it can be, you know, harder because they don't have that person to talk with about their plans. So just from a practical standpoint, I notice that sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Good points. Do you think, whether single or married, people could do, should do their own retirement planning? I know that's kind of a broad, vague question, but.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it is interesting, the idea of doing their own retirement planning. Some of it is, what does that actually mean? Like, can they go in and set up a transfer from a brokerage account to their personal account? Absolutely. But to do the type of planning that an advisor will do, when we're talking about optimizing, I don't think they're going to optimize it in the same way we will, or think about the considerations. So I think it comes down to, okay, what is the cost of not optimizing, and thinking through that? You know, somebody with less money, maybe there's not as big of a trade-off, where if somebody has an extra $10,000 in cash that could have been earning 5% versus the person with $200,000 in cash that they've been letting sit in a savings account earning nothing, that's a big difference, right? So I think it's those things. It's, what's the difference in cost of not fully optimizing and maybe making the best choices? What's that financial cost? Because I don't think most people can do it at the level that we're talking, but I think some can get by enough, and it maybe won't hurt them long term by maybe starting Social Security sooner than they should, or some of the other decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of folks we come across, you know, average folks, consumers, who are really good DIYers, especially with the investing part, the tax part, the broader other financial area part. There's a lot of really astute folks, but, you know, a lot of folks, I think, can do it well enough where they got the big boulders, the heavy lifting done.
Yeah.
Optimization, the tweaking, the fine tuning may not be as good as if they were working with someone who knows what they're doing, but is that going to ruin them in the end? Probably not.
Right.
So, you know, those folks, I think, are fine to self-manage, self-plan.
Yeah.
If people do want to work with an advisor, and just let me throw in there, an advisor is so much more than just investment management. I think most people typically think of advisor and they think, oh, that's just someone that picks investments. Show me your returns, or I bet I can do better than you, or my portfolio did better than index funds you use over the last 10 years. So why would I hire you? that's just such a super, super small part of it. Like we already started alluding to, there's so much other stuff that goes into planning retirement, be it financial, non-financial, tax related. That's the real value. But anyway, with that said, if people are, you know, have come to the conclusion that they think it's worth it for them to consider working with an advisor slash planner, whatever you want to call them, what are some things they should consider, questions they should ask, et cetera?
Yeah. Yeah. One comment on the last question. Like, I've even hired a financial advisor to do a plan for me twice over the last 10 years. Before my wife left her job, we met with a planner to have a plan done. And then also before starting my business, just to make sure, because one of the temptations I think for people is to maybe make the assumptions a little more favorable for what they're wanting to do. And I know that bias can exist for me. So I actually hired an advisor. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people that don't need to hire somebody ongoing, but you're right. With those big boulders, it's very smart to find somebody that can help at least review. And even if they give you check marks on everything and you didn't do it, everything's perfect, it's helpful to know and worth the money. That's kind of how we felt with it. We didn't really learn a lot of new stuff, but we both felt the peace of mind from knowing we weren't missing anything. So I think with that kind of as a caveat there, you know, if somebody does come to the point where they say, hey, I want to work with an advisor to at least figure it out or on an ongoing basis, several things that I'm thinking about is education. You know, do they have the training? What credentials do they have? You know, CFP is one of the best, in my opinion. Experience working with people in your life stage. You know, I find it very interesting when I'm telling someone, you know, I only work with retirees, and they're like, yeah, this other advisor specializes in retirees. But then you look at the website and they work with people of every age. It doesn't matter. Right. It's like, that's not what we mean by specialization. So like making sure that they work with people like you in your stage, you're going to be able to get better service. Making sure they're fiduciaries, you know, where they're legally obligated to work in your best interest is very important. Understand how the advisor gets paid and the fees you pay. You know, it's surprising how many people don't know how much they're paying, even in just management fees. They don't know, even if they think it's 1%, or sometimes they'll even say, hey, I'm not paying anything. It's like, well, you paid something at some point. They're not doing this for free. So just knowing what you're paying management fees, but also underlying investment fees, and just what are you paying in total, I think is important to know. Right. What experience do they have in tax planning? Where we're talking, you know, you can dig a little deeper and saying, you know, will you review my tax return? Will you provide tax projections and advice related to what I should do? Those, because they might say, yeah, we do tax planning. But when you start saying, will you tell me how much to convert each year? That's when you might start getting, hey, we can't really do that level of detail. That's tax advice. You need to talk to your CPA. That may not be the best fit. And just making sure for retirees that they know how to do distribution plans. A couple other ones are just, you know, how many households do they serve? And making sure that number is reasonable. That's an important part. You know, my goal is to have around 50. I think, Andy, you're about the same households. And I feel like I can do a good job for that number. If somebody has 100 or 200, you might want to be cautious there. And then also just thinking through, you know, if you're about to hire an advisor, you know, are they, you don't really want someone that's planning their own retirement unless you don't mind changing advisor. So just having that in mind is, you know, how much longer do they plan to work, just to make sure it aligns with your horizon as well.
Yeah, those are great points. There is a lack, but it's slowly getting addressed, of advisors. I forget the statistic, but the average age of someone with the CFP is, it's like 60 or something. I don't know what it is. Yeah. I could be putting this up, but point is, it's an aging industry. A lot of people in it are, you know, well beyond 40-ish, you know, toward the latter part of their careers. So for folks that are entering retirement, looking for someone to hopefully be around as long or longer than they are, just do the math, right? Don't hire someone who's 70 if you're 55 entering retirement, because you're right, certainly going to outlive that person. Now, yeah, if they work at a large firm and have a, you know, well-defined process for continuity of service and whatever, so be it. But like you, like I, you know, in our 30s and our 40s, I think that we're sort of like the sweet spot, you know, been around the industry, right, have enough experience, yet still younger than the folks we work with. So in theory, should, you know, be around longer than they are.
Right.
Barring any, you know, health issues or what have you. So
yeah,
here's an interesting question that I probably think more about than I should, to an unhealthy degree, the quote unquote value of, yeah, of financial planning, of having an advisor, a planner. I have strong views about this, about can it be measured or whatever? Can you try to set a fee off of value? And I think you know where I'm going with this, but what's your view on the value of planning? Could you attempt to put some numbers around it, you know, measure it, et cetera?
Yeah, no, it is an interesting question. I think there are certain things, which I know you'd agree with this, that you probably could put a dollar value on. There's a lot of them that you could put a potential future value on, like right. Roth conversions. We're hoping to save money in our late 80s, maybe 90s, right? That's when we really start seeing the benefits. So do you call that value today? Do you do a discounted value, like present value, right? So, I mean, it does get complicated. I don't try to put that kind of value on it. I think it is tough to actually measure, but our clients obviously can tell, you know, with the tax planning, there are dollars being saved. And then with just the peace of mind from doing good retirement planning, the value is obviously there for them to stay with us. But I agree mostly with you that I generally don't think you can put a value on it. It's hard to quantify. It's called hard to say whether it's massive or how big the value is. I think, but clients know it's there.
Yeah. Or if they don't, you know, they'll leave or not hire you in the first place.
Right. Yep.
And I think value, the definition of value, how much value someone gets is so unique and personalized to them. Some people more so than others will have a lot of emotional subjective value on it. The sleeping well at night, peace of mind value right. can be invaluable to them. Mm-hmm. And they may gladly pay $10,000, $15,000 a year, whatever, because they know they're taken care of and you know, Brian's on it. Other folks yeah. will nitpick over, you know, every $1,000 a year you charge. They'll want to see, show me exactly how you produced for me $1,000 that I otherwise wouldn't have had.
Yeah.
Those folks, they're never going to be good relationships for anyone, not because they're bad people, just they're not going to be able to see and get the value out of it if they're just purely looking at nitpicking dollars and cents.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, we'll stop there. I mean, you know, I can chat for this for a yeah. time, but
yeah.
So about retirement planning, where do you go personally for content, be it blogs, YouTube, books, whatever, you know, where do you learn to lean to learn things and expand your knowledge?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of split it into advisors, like kind of advisor resources. I mean, even think our study group that we're in monthly, I'm in a couple other ones, is a great place to learn from other advisors who are also learning. Michael Kitsis you got to read his stuff. It's excellent for advisors. Some other ones, you know, Ed Slott does a lot with taxes, Jeff Levine. A lot of what I read tends to be tax focused, but then also the life planning element as well. Andy, you turned me on to the book Life and Death Planning for Retirement Benefits. I mean, that's an excellent read for retirement related resources. Maybe not an excellent read, but great resource. Yeah. And then just a couple non-financial was like Beyond the Numbers with Reed Stone and then Mitch Anthony. He's excellent on return on life. And then also The New Retirementality. He's got a great book on just thinking beyond the finances, which I like. Consumer, have to put you on the list, Andy. You have a lot of great resources. I really like Fritz Gilbert, The Retirement Manifesto. He even had a thing on Roth conversions recently that would be worth checking out, an article. Roger Whitney's great. And I listen to a lot of YouTube videos, and it would just be tough to name everybody, but YouTube's a great place to get good videos.
Yeah. Fritz is awesome. I'm glad he does what he does. It's
me
really
too.
Well-written, easy to understand, super practical information. So.
Yeah. I mean, his chart too on Roth conversions, I've even sent it to a couple of clients just because I think he says it really well on the benefits of Roth conversions, especially the next couple of years. So,
yeah. And I will Brian, I'll follow up with you to get, you know, all this stuff so I can put it in the notes of the show links. To
okay.
All right. Let's talk about some practice specific questions about you and well, your business. How do you know if someone is a good fit for you? Not them vetting you, but you vetting them. Like what makes someone a good client for you and what you do?
Yeah. So what I do is I have a 30-minute call to kind of have a conversation that generally gives me what I need to know. So one, I'm making sure, are they over 50 and asking questions about retirement? That's a prerequisite. If they're not, then I'm not. Most of the time they see it on my website and don't even schedule a call. Some will sneak in and we just have that. That's pretty obvious. They're not a good fit. One, you know, making sure that I understand what they're looking for, you know, what their expectations are. One way I do that is asking, have they worked with an advisor? Because sometimes if they have, I can figure out why it didn't work and just make sure that that's a good fit. Because sometimes the things they're expecting are not something I'm going to deliver. I think a big thing too is investment philosophy is just making sure we're aligned with using index funds, which we'll get into that. But if they're not aligned there, that can be set up for disappointment. But it really is not about a sales pitch. It's about wanting, I want to make sure they're a good fit because it's a lot of work to bring on a client for them to decide it's not a good fit, or for me to decide it's not a good fit. So for in the 30 minutes, that's really what I'm looking for. And then there's also just an element of personality and likability that's hard to quantify, but I think it's there. We both can sense it if it's there. And if not, then we won't have a second call.
Yeah.
And then I do a second call just to learn more about their finances, their goals and values. And then from that second call, decide if it's a good fit. But the screening process is pretty good to help me decide if it's someone I'd want to work with. And then they also make the decision.
And that's important. I'm glad you said that. With smaller places like us that are intentional about it and want it to be small and manageable, we're not looking to build empires. You want, like you said, 50-ish households of clients. There's a limited number of seats on the bus, was a phrase I heard someone say. And you want to make sure that the people on that bus are good fits mutually. So it's good that you're selective, as are other smaller, you know, folks that we know in this circle, about who they work with, because they want to have good relationships that hopefully stick around a while, where both parties get something out of it. Yeah. Whereas, and I'm not knocking any firm in particular, but a lot of the big places, the household name places, they're just meat market volume machines where if you can fog a mirror, you can be a client, you know, you're qualified to be their client. Or maybe there's a small minimum, you know, $100,000 asset minimum or something. But they don't care how good of a fit it is. They just need to hit numbers and get people in the door and get assets under management, right? So I'll stop there. But it just, you know, it's some people think it's concerning to work with a small place, but I can flip the script quite easily and say quite the opposite. You'll almost certainly get better attention and service and relationship out of a small place than a big meat marketplace where you're one of, you know, 300, 400 relationships this person's supposed to manage.
Right.
Anyway. So you talked about how you vet someone who you think would be a good fit for you, and, you know, not just you're a good fit for them. Or if they're not, have you ever had to quote unquote fire a client? And if so, why, if you're willing and able to say?
No, I have not had to fire a client yet, which is good.
Okay.
I think some of that does go to the good process of having a two meeting process to screen and get to know each other. I have had people I've done a one-time plan for where it's, even if they wanted to come back, I wouldn't. And that, you know, could be personality, but yeah, but no ongoing clients have to be fired at this point.
Okay. It's not fun or comfortable, and that has to happen. We already started talking about this, but investment management, what's your overall view and process toward investment management in your firm?
Yeah. So keeping it very simple, using low cost index funds, not trying to beat the stock market, basically getting index returns, and for retirees using a combination of, you know, cash and fixed income to cover X number of years of spending, and then having a limited number of equity investments on top of that, US and international, but keeping the portfolio number of investments simple, trying to simplify the accounts and consolidate things as much as we can. So it's really more of a passive index fund approach.
Yeah. There's value in simplicity.
There is.
A lot of people increasingly see that as they age, whether it's for their own benefit, or, you know, they don't want to lose a bird's nest worth of random accounts and stuff to their heirs to have to deal with, and positions and whatever. So, benchmarking. So you already said you don't try to beat the market, nor do I. I think that's a futile loser's game to try to do. But with that said, do clients ask about returns, and or do you benchmark the returns of the portfolios you see, you manage, versus some, you know, index or stated benchmark?
Yeah, they occasionally ask, and if they do, we'll talk about it. But I don't generally do any formal benchmarking. We did at the previous firm. I think it's a little more relevant if your value is in trying to beat the market, then you should probably demonstrate that you've either done that or have to tell them you didn't. But when you're buying the benchmark, it seems a little less important to show the return to the benchmark. And I think clients understand that and haven't really asked too much for return information.
I'm sure it comes down to the vetting process again, right? You make it clear that's your approach, that's what you do.
Exactly.
No one should be hiring you, expecting you to say, hey, look, we outperformed the market by X percent this month, you know, or whatever. Okay. Setting of expectations. Yeah. Annuities, always a hot topic. I'm sure we can go lots of ways with this, but what's your view and use of annuities, you know, if at all, in your firm?
Yeah, I think the short answer is I consider them a tool. So I don't rule them out as an option, but I do think in some of it might just be attracting people that are more interested in index funds and kind of buying into the philosophy, where generally they're not as interested in annuities. And in fact, it's kind of and spend more time helping people get out of annuities they were sold 10 years ago or 15 years ago than buying them. But I do have some clients, if they took a lump sum, you know, maybe they do want to get an annuity, or they are interested in annuitizing some of their resources. But I think for some, it sounds good in theory, sometimes works well on paper. But when it comes to turning over the money and actually buying it, I'm not seeing clients actually wanting to do that as much at this point.
Yeah. And to be clear, you don't have insurance license. You don't sell annuities, right?
So. No. I'd refer them out if they want one.
Yeah. Fair. Is my approach as well. Similar question around trust. Now, trust can be lots of different things that have different purposes, but let's just for now assume the basic plain vanilla living revocable trust. Common question is, do I need one? What could it do for me? Et cetera, et cetera. And you're not a lawyer, I'm not holding you to any answers here, but what's your view, thoughts about living revocable trusts for clients if they ask, or do you recommend them?
Yeah, so I don't, and I work with a couple local attorneys, and they kind of have a similar approach where it's, everyone does not need a trust, which some of them come to us because they went to a seminar and were told that they need to get a trust, but not everyone needs it. There are some reasons to have it, whether special needs, you know, if you have somebody who has special needs, or you're concerned about someone spending too much, so there's kind of control. And then also if there's kids involved and you want to have a little more control over when the money is received, you know, you could do a trust that way. It does add some complexity. You know, you can accomplish a lot of it with good beneficiary designations, transfer on death, payable on death. So, I mean, you can try to replicate some of that. If people have mostly their money in IRAs, generally they're not getting a trust. And we're just keeping it simple, estate planning is very important, still getting the four or five main documents that you need, but a trust generally is not one of them for just a typical retiree that I work with.
Right. Agreed. I heard an interesting personal story from Cody Garrett about a month ago, maybe, in his own experiences with, I believe it was his grandmother who passed, and Cody was the executor, I think. And the benefit of a trust in this particular circumstance. So one thing with a trust is it's private. When someone dies, anything that's in that trust isn't public knowledge, what's in there. Versus if someone dies and their house, for example, passes through the probate process through their will, that is public record. And people could find out that, hey, you know, Jane Smith died and her house went through probate. So Cody had mentioned that his grandmother died and realtors started calling him, because I guess they go and do searches of who died and did they own a house.
Yeah.
Or started calling him to try to sell her house. Had the house been owned by a trust, that would have all got bypassed. The realtors would not have been able to find out the grandmother died and the house was presumably going to be sold. So I thought that was interesting. I never heard that before. I still don't think for most people it's enough to say, yeah, go ahead and get a trust. But for those that are interested in the privacy aspect of things like that, then that's one of the benefits to consider with having a trust. But outside of that, yeah, I mean, my view is I think they're probably generally overused. Doesn't mean they're harmful per se, but it's, you know, not really necessary in many cases.
Yeah. And just for people listening, I mean, if you have a beneficiary designation on the account, it's not going to go through probate. So that's going to be private and passed through beneficiary. So it's only things that do not have a beneficiary designation on them.
Yeah.
That would pass through probate.
Point. Long-term care. This is a big one, common question. There's lots of different ways long-term care can be addressed or not. Just hope and pretend it won't happen, which I think is what many people do. But what's your thoughts and view and process around long-term care and potentially insuring or not insuring, et cetera?
Yeah. So I do run, when I'm running retirement models, I do like to run an alternative scenario that includes some level of care, whether it's home care, whether it's, you know, needing to go to a facility for some number of years, just to see what's the impact on the plan. And most of my clients tend to self-insure, and it could just be the net worth that they have, but generally they're self-insuring and just find that the cost of the plan and what they provide is not necessarily worth paying for.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do have a good resource in Columbus. So like people that are interested, whether it's a single individual or a couple, often what I find is somebody who's recently went through an experience with a parent, they can see some of that on that side. So they might be more interested in at least talking more. So I'll refer them. But so far, you know, I don't think any of them have actually went through buying a policy, but they've at least appreciated going through the process, talking to somebody who can explain it well to learn about their options.
Yeah. And same thing like annuities, you don't have licenses to sell long-term care insurance.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no license to sell any insurance products. I just have a lot of great resources for legal and insurance that I just refer people to.
Yeah. And just side note, same thing, like you're not a lawyer. You don't create, draft, and execute wills and powers of attorney for people. Doesn't mean they're not important. Doesn't mean you don't get involved in giving your right. thoughts and views on it for people. But when the time comes for someone to actually get that product or service, you have to, you know, rely on a network of professionals who do just that.
Yep.
Sort of something slightly off track here, but something that kind of rubs me the wrong way is a lot of folks who do sell insurance will say, like, you can't be a good advisor if you don't sell insurance and provide that to people. Or
yeah.
like, I'm already doing some of the insurance work and recommendations for someone. Why shouldn't I also be the one to sell them the product? And my view is, for what it's worth, is like, yeah, I see that point of view, but you can't be all things to all people. Like many who are raised in the insurance world, to them, it's second nature and feel like, how could you be an advisor if you don't sell insurance? But insurance isn't necessarily more important than getting a will in place. Yet advisors don't think I have to be a lawyer and do the will for clients. No, they're glad to give up the will to a lawyer to do.
Right.
You know, mortgages, whether it's a reverse mortgage or traditional mortgage, same thing, even doing taxes, people need it done. Most advisors don't do taxes, won't touch it. They'll gladly farm it out to someone. But when it comes to insurance, there's still like the stranglehold that kind of yeah. the insurance industry and mindset has on the yeah. advisory world. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now. Distribution plans. This is a common question. And I'm kind of wrapping together a bunch of different questions and concerns I've heard from folks. But so by distribution, I mean just in regards of like investable portfolio and taking money out of it. Do you have yeah. a standard approach or process for doing that, or kind of, you know, what do you do toward distribution planning with folks?
Yeah. So using retirement planning software to get the high level view, just to make sure that the amount that we're wanting to spend makes sense. And generally, you know, clients are wanting to spend more in the first, you know, 10 or 15 years, so that there is a little higher spending there. So making sure we have a good overall plan. And then I do use spreadsheets to do a 5-year projection for cash flow and taxes, which I think helps. And then also looking at the withdrawal rate percentage there, I think gives them a little more peace of mind. And generally, unless clients have all IRAs, generally what I'll do is start by just setting up a monthly distribution from a taxable account. And then that's kind of where the money comes from. And then if we want to do an IRA distribution, we can and put it into the taxable. So it's kind of coming from the taxable account. And then as part of the tax estimate, that's where we're seeing the tax withholding that we need to have. And also seeing, are there any other opportunities, whether it's Roth conversions, harvesting gains in paying 0%, what are some other opportunities that we may have in addition to good, you know, distribution planning?
Yeah. What are your thoughts, if someone were to ask you, client or prospect, hey, Brian, what do you think about the 4% rule? Or what do you think about, I don't know, like the term guardrails, or there's something else, sort of bumpers, people may call it, where yeah. you take out fluctuates based on how your portfolio is doing. If someone asks you that, they say they want that, or ask your view on that, what do you say about those things?
Yeah, I think it's a helpful framework when you're not quite at retirement, you're saying, hey, am I on the right track? And you just want a quick way to see if you're on track. I think it's helpful. But for a retiree who is 60, 65, hasn't started Social Security, their withdrawal rate can be quite a bit higher than 4 yeah. because then once they start that. So I think for some people, it limits what they can spend, because most of my clients are actually saying, hey, we love our kids. We've saved really well. We want to spend as much as we can and enjoy ourselves. And they can, you know, if they receive something great. So, I mean, if that's the goal, to maximize spending, I think you're limiting it with the 4% rule, but you still need to have good boundaries. So like when I'm looking at the withdrawal percentage, I'm okay if it's 5 or 6% initially, if once we start Social Security, we get down to a more manageable level. Plus, yeah. I'm also looking at what ability do they have to adjust. If we're spending $30,000 or $40,000 on travel and that's part of it, that can probably be dialed back in some years versus somebody who's the budget's a little more tight, they have less flexibility, then we may want to be closer to the 4% if there's not as much variability.
Right. That makes sense. And do you put these plans, these recommendations in something written, formal, deliverable for folks? Or is it an ongoing process where kind of year to year you discuss what you're going to
yeah.
do?
Yeah, it is ongoing. Okay. It's I do the 5 year, we're really focused more on that first year. And I show them the other 4 years just for perspective, letting them know that we're going to update this every year and it's going to change. But just so they kind of understand where we're headed, I look at that. But it is something we update every year. But I do give them the cash flow projection because I do think that helps people understand where the money is coming from. And they like seeing it laid out. Even the retirement model, it's helpful for us. And to some level, it's helpful for them and provides some reassurance. But it's so much data that breaking it down into 5 years is helpful for them to see, okay, this is what I'm spending. This is where the money is coming from. This is the shortfall. Now let's take it from this account. It's helpful to see it laid out on a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. We sort of touched on this already, but tax planning opportunities, what sort of things do you commonly come across with clients, typical retiree, pre-retiree clients?
Yeah. So for new retirees, you know, filling up the lower tax brackets, whether that's Roth conversions, whether there's the opportunity for capital gains if they're in the 12% bracket at 0%. Also making sure we're looking at Social Security. I think sometimes people forget that the IRA income or capital gains will can cause Social Security to be taxable if they're receiving it. So needing to factor that in. Tax loss harvesting, healthcare subsidy planning is an opportunity for people before they're 65. So just looking at controlling income if they're receiving subsidies. Charitable giving strategies. I have several clients that do charitable giving. So there's several opportunities there with donor advised funds, qualified charitable distributions if they're over 70 and a half, and then just gifting appreciated stock. So looking for opportunities there since most people aren't itemizing like they used to.
Right.
And then just improving the tax efficiency of taxable accounts is also one way that we can improve taxes and reduce taxes.
Okay. There's definitely a lot of levers to be pulled under the umbrella of tax planning. You just touched on a lot of great and common areas and examples of tax planning for the typical retiree. But we can go down rabbit holes as well, trying to optimize to the nth degree. And a lot of these things are hard to quantitatively and precisely solve for as being the best, especially with any sort of guarantee, like the best outcome that they can possibly have. So how do you balance getting too complicated, too optimized, too in the weeds to the point it's like diminishing returns and you know, not making things unnecessarily complicated or cumbersome, yet still have a robust hearty plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm looking at what is the tax savings now, if there is tax savings that we'll realize now, or what's the potential future tax savings, and making sure that it's worth the time commitment involved, either for me as the advisor or the client has to do something. And I think clients' tolerance for that is a little different, where some clients, if they could save $1,000 in taxes, would feel like, I absolutely want to do that. And other ones are like, that's rounding. Why are you bothering me talking about something like that? So some of that depends.
Yeah. I like that. Very client specific, right? Some people, often engineers, will want things really buttoned up as optimized as possible. And every, you know, tens of dollars matters in the projections. Other folks are like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. And I thought of one example I thought of is just even health savings accounts. You know, it sounds great to track your expenses in a spreadsheet, but I don't know how many retirees really are keeping a spreadsheet of every medical expense so they can take a tax-free distribution. Right. They're just banking on future medical expenses. I mean, it sounds good and some do it, and it would be nice if you did it, but is it necessary? We're probably going to have medical expenses later that we can do distributions for. So that's kind of one of those things where some do, some don't, and I don't strongly encourage them one way or the other on something like that.
Makes sense. So this one's a big one, very common question. Probably most people approaching or planning for their retirements come across at some point is having enough. How do you help people determine whether or not they have quote unquote enough to retire or whatever their plans or goals might be?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is an interesting, that is kind of a loaded question because enough, there's like a financial enough where under what were reasonable expectations and assumptions, they do have enough money to last until the end. Now, do they feel like they have enough is a very different conversation. So I think I use retirement modeling software, you know, using my spreadsheet, looking at withdrawal rates. I think that provides some peace of mind that they have enough when we're saying, like even referencing the 4%, if you're withdrawing 1% or 2% and we could probably go up to 4%, you're probably going to be okay. You know, so I think that helps them at least financially have enough. Now, working through that, feeling like they have enough is different. Cause I mean, I know clients that, you know, Social Security is going to cover a large part, in some cases, even all of their spending. And yet they're still worried they're going to run out of money when they have a lot of money. Plus, so it is interesting just to see. And then some people have a lot less and they're very confident and maybe even overly confident about their plan.
Yeah, that's true. There are some folks that objectively, it's very easy to say you have enough, like pension security alone more than covers everything you need, right? The money you do have saved in your IRA, 401k, brokerage account, whatever. That, I mean, that's just gravy that we want you to try to spend, yet they may still feel like they don't have enough.
Right.
How you help them with that. That's more of like a, you need to be a psychiatrist at that point and dig deeper. Like, you know, with your life planning, I'm sure you're much better at this than I am. There's something belying that view that they can't let themselves acknowledge that they have enough.
Yeah.
What is that? What's their money script? What's their history? What's, you know, what's the family dynamics that are leading to that?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think some of it is the financial life planning is helpful, asking some of those questions, learning about money growing up. And you might notice some people may need to talk to like a financial therapist. It might be at that level, right? But generally, some of those conversations over time can help them work through it.
Yeah. Good. Now, for those that do have enough, another common issue with people that make the transition to retirement is, even if they know they have enough, by whatever their definitions are, struggle to actually spend it, to flip the switch, to go from a lifetime of accumulating to now decumulating. What do you do? How do you try to help people get over that hump and get comfortable with spending what they saved their money?
I really do think, you know, objectively, like you said, we have the resources to show it objectively. And I think some of it is over time, helping them get comfortable by having the conversation, some level of even just normalizing. This is very common for retirees to feel this way. You know, the first 6 months to a year, it's very common. You know, you are in this position, you're in this great position because you're a saver, and now you're going to have to learn how to spend. It may be tough to do, but we'll work through it. So I think just some of that helps them realize that it's very normal to make that transition. And I think a lot of them get used to it pretty quickly, especially after that first nice trip. It's like, it was a thing of the past of struggling, but there is a period of time. And I don't worry too much about it the first year.
Yeah. Just because it's common and generally it'll pass.
Yeah. That's my opinion. And I do think some of the life planning helps as you're kind of talking through some of it, you're getting to know their values and goals. So you can talk about the importance. Hey, you know, you said this was really important to you. By spending more, we're going to be able to do that. I think that also helps them lean more towards spending, but it does take time for some people. And then it's a challenge when one spouse is willing and the other one's not, of just, you know, working through that as well.
It's always hard. Yeah. Now for those that don't have enough, and they might think they do, how do you help them? How do you help them adapt, adjust, et cetera? Or sometimes where it's just lost cases and you kind of have to part ways because you can see a train wreck slowly happening.
Yeah. It is tough. You know, it's funny. I was doing a one-time plan for somebody and I was using a much more conservative assumption for returns, and he was using a much larger return. And he ended up saying, he laughed and said that when he used the same return as I did, cause he used it, he had to work until his mid-70s and he didn't want to do that. But it's like, that's not how we fix this problem, is by just changing our return assumption. So I think some of it is just thinking through, you know, if you don't like your current job, you know, there is a possibility just to stay there a little longer. There is part-time work, which there are benefits beyond financial for working in retirement. So that's an option of finding something you enjoy and earning some level of income. If they're still working, they could try to save more, analyze their spending a little more, and just maybe there's opportunities to reduce spending. Maybe they don't need as much in retirement. You know, maybe they could downsize their home. But I mean, there's only so many things you can do, but it does require some tough changes and changing some habits. So there's not always easy answers, but some of it may involve working part-time. But like I said, that's not necessarily that bad to have to do.
And for most folks, I think working longer, even if just part-time, is probably one of the most important levers or most impactful levers you have. You really need to beef up, you know, your retirement longevity and projection longevity. It's hard for some people to hear that, but it can make a huge difference adding a year or two of income. Because not only are you adding income, you're not taking money out of the portfolio that you otherwise would have. So you kind of avoid double doozy there.
Yep.
Last few questions here. If you can give only one piece of advice or word of wisdom to consumers, not other advisors, about retirement planning, what would it be?
So my thought is to not get lost in the spreadsheet and just, you know, being intentional with time and prioritizing their health. Because at the end of the day, we can optimize this plan. We can have the perfect plan. But if we don't have time, if we run out of time or we run out of our health, then it really doesn't matter. So I think that's the big part, is just making sure that time, they're managing their time and their health well as they retire.
Yeah, very important. This is a hard one. What question, if any, do you think I should have asked you but didn't? And what's your answer to that question?
So I did think of one thing we didn't talk about. I'm not sure it's so much a question, it's just more of a statement or kind of a public service announcement in a way, but just we didn't touch on Medicare that much. I don't know, we really didn't talk about Medicare at all. And my caution to people would just be careful about Medicare Advantage plans, understand the pros and cons, and just make sure you're making a good choice for yourself, because they are enticing. And for some people, they can be the better fit. But I think one thing to know is, you know, there's guaranteed issue rights, and just understanding what that means as you're getting on Medicare and the implications of that. And I don't know if we want to get into it here, but I think that's an important thing that people need to understand is, with the guaranteed issued rights, you may not be able to get back into traditional Medicare if you go the Advantage route. So that's just something to be mindful of.
Yeah. If you don't mind, if you got a few more minutes, let's touch on that. If it is an important point, I know we're going with this, maybe just expand more on guaranteed issue rights. Yeah. What the issue is here.
And just kind of a quick story to set the stage for it. You know, I interviewed three, I wanted to find a good Medicare resource. I interviewed three local people and they were all telling me and showing me reports on Advantage plans were the way to go. Then I went to a conference and there was someone at the conference that was like a fee only Medicare person. So she just charged a fee to do it. And she was totally against Advantage plans. And I was shocked because I was like, oh yeah, I've got some great resources already. And she was totally shocked that these people were telling me Advantage plans were the best and started educating me on these guaranteed issue rights. So that's kind of what opened my eyes and ended up finding a good local person who does generally recommend traditional Medicare. But with guaranteed issue rights, what it means is when you turn 65, you can get on traditional Medicare without underwriting and without having to have good health. They have to accept you and they can't charge you more because you're unhealthy. So that's what you get when you're just getting on Medicare with guaranteed issued rights. If you get on an Advantage plan and change your mind a couple of years later, you can go back potentially, but now you have to go through the medical underwriting process. And someone in their 60s, you know, maybe your health isn't as good. So there could be an issue there of being able to go back. And one of the challenges is the Advantage plans have all the great commercials with all the celebrities. They're throwing in gym memberships. You can get some free eyeglasses every year and get your teeth cleaned. And it sounds great. And this other plan, that plan is free, by the way, for a lot of people, or you can pay $100 a month for traditional Medicare and they're not going to do the dental. They're not going to give you the glasses. You got to pay for your own gym. So it doesn't sound as enticing, but once you actually need care longer term, the regular supplements can provide better care. And that's where I think the people that know it are the ones who just helped a parent, an aging parent through the process. And they're like, oh, I already know. I am not going down that route. So not that they're bad for everybody. For some people, just financially, maybe that's where they need to go. But it's at least understanding that once you make that choice, it can be tough to go back.
That's great input. I've heard that before. And the first time I learned of that guaranteed issue, you know, no underwriting when you first turn 65 to go on traditional Medicare, that was a real eye-opener for me that I didn't know about. So glad you brought that up. All right. Awesome. Brian, thank you. So if people want to find out more about you, about your firm, where can they go?
You can go to my website, trulyprosperfp.com is the best place.
Okay. And we'll have that in the link to this notes, to the episode. Cool. Brian, thank you very much. Thank you everyone for listening. Always a pleasure. Any final words of wisdom here?
No, thanks for having me, Andy. This was fun.
Thank you. Take care, everyone. Okay. That was it for my chat with Brian Tegmeyer. Hope you all enjoyed that. I know I did. Super sharp guy, like the way he does things, like the way he thinks, and his approach towards the business, towards retirement planning, heart's in the right spot, offers things that people truly find value in, isn't just managing investments like we discussed. It's good, warms my heart to come across other folks like Brian who are in this for the right reasons and doing a really good service for folks. So anyway, hope you enjoyed that. As always, if you like this podcast, please give a nice, super rosy review and thumbs up on Apple Podcasts or wherever you go to find your podcast. And also check out the Facebook group by the same name as this podcast, Retirement Planning Education, the YouTube channel by the same name as this podcast, and my company's newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to all these things in the notes of this episode. That's that. Thank you as always for listening, and I will see you next week. Take care.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.